you know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Alec Purcell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, and my second script is pages from being done.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life, and I'm currently in pre-production of my third feature, Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep and a distribution consultant, and I used to manage Sundance's creative distribution initiative.
On this Thursday bonus episode, we're going to play the interview from episode 152 from way back in April of 2018 with Ian James Duncan, who talked about making a web series fan film based on, well, it's not a fan film, it's a fan web series based on Half-Life, which received over a million views online. I thought this was a really good match for the Ren team because they both talk about web series, you know, making web series, working on a web series, promoting a web series, and how they can, and it just shows how they can be approached differently. Like Ren did, you know, 2 5-episode seasons. With Ian, he did 3 episodes. So, you know, it's kind of a different approach. After that, we play another round of The Game. But first, don't forget to check out our Patreon page, www.patreon.com/MMIHpodcast. That is where you can help support the show, keep it alive, keep it moving and grooving. And also make sure to rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts, which is hugely, hugely, hugely helpful. Thank you to Atlantis, Tim Chismar, for the review from last week. But without any other further bibble babble, here's our throwback interview with Ian James Duncan. So today we have Ian James Duncan on the show.
Hi.
And he has done something that a lot of people have been doing more lately, but, you know, kind of, I think when he started wasn't that popular, but he made a fan film series, actually, called Half-Life, The Freeman Chronicles. And yeah, we wanted to have him come on and talk about this. I actually, just before I introduced Ian, it's kind of a funny story of how we met. I actually met Ian at AFM last year, just roaming the halls of AFM, trying to pitch my movie and introduce myself to production companies. And he was in the halls too. And I think we said hello or something. And then in the lobby, we connected and we just chatted for like 30, 45 minutes. And it was like the last day, I think, or the second to last day. And we just kind of hit it off. And he told his story. I told my story of the trip. And it was interesting. So yeah, I'm really glad to have Ian on the show. Welcome, Ian.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I was kind of blown away because you told me how many views your product has gotten, or your product, your films have gotten, your Half-Life films.
Could be called a product.
You meant to say project.
Project. Yeah. It was pretty amazing. And then, like, you know, you were kind of having some struggles, you know, talking to people just like everybody. And I was like, man, you should be knocking them dead with that, those kinds of numbers. Oh my God. I wish I had those. I have like, you know, not even 300,000 hits on my stuff.
How many hits do you have, Ian?
You know what? I'd have to look, but it's got to be a million plus, I think, on the first episode. Yeah.
I did my math on it. And I think altogether, I counted just shy of 2 million. So like 1.8 million or something like that total of the ones that you could count. But then it's on Steam too. And I couldn't figure out how to count on Steam. And I bet a lot of people watch it on Steam.
Yeah, it's got some love on Steam for sure. It was kind of a blessing, really, to get it on there finally. I just happened to meet somebody at Valve at a gaming convention a few years ago, and just started talking to them, and they're like, oh yeah, we know about that. If you ever want any help or whatever, just let us know and we'll put it on Steam. And I'm like, what?
Okay. Yes, please.
Yeah. And that
That's
was it.
Really awesome.
And they said once it was done, you know, they'd support it and whatever. But obviously there are very strict rules about fan films and how they're monetized and things. And so, you know, you have to be careful of that.
Right. Like how many views can you get? And if you are monetized, when does the person who owns that property come in and be like, no, you can't make money off of this.
Yeah. They have some good copy on their site about letting you use their assets to make money and stuff like that. But we never monetized anything really. So it was really, for me, just about getting it in the place where the most people that were likely to be interested in it would see it, which was cool.
So I never played Half-Life. This is a video game.
What? You never played Half-Life? I thought you'd be a big Half-Life person.
No.
Wow.
Are you a gamer?
I'm a gamer, but I don't know why I never got into Half-Life. I think I tend to focus more on action games, and anything that takes more than I'd say 25 hours to finish, it's really hard for me to get into. Although the last few games, I feel like I've played
Half-Life's
like
action,
Persona 5 recently, and Witcher 3, which were both like 100 plus hours, but I tend not to go towards those games, and Half-Life seems like it's more of that kind of game, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, and it was a pretty hardcore PC game as well. You had to be a hardcore PC gamer, I think, to
well, there you go. I'm not, to play. I'm not right. a PC fucking, gamer, yeah. or nor am I hardcore.
Yeah. Well, maybe hardcore is the wrong word, but you know, right. you had to have a PC and be able to, right. you know, a graphics card at the time and whatnot for the original one. It was pretty long time ago.
To play the original Half-Life, especially, and then in Half-Life 2 even more so. And then, but now Half-Life 2, I think, out on Xbox and stuff, and so
yeah,
you can sort of
did.
Play it.
It transitioned yeah. to the PS3 or PS1 or PS something, I don't know, at
yeah.
some point as well.
Yeah.
I'm kind of a former gamer now. I
oh,
like
really?
To still think I play games, but I never get the chance.
That's funny.
Once a gamer, always a gamer.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I say.
I buy games still. I've got like loads of games in my Steam library that I've never played.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
That's how we all are here. We've all got yeah. all these games. The Steam sale comes around and we're like, oh, we got to get this and that. And then we never play them.
Just because you have no time to play them anymore?
Yeah. And I think, you know, I worked for several years in the gaming industry as well. And so I played a lot of games and I don't know. Maybe that just takes it out of you. You're just not.
You lost your passion?
Yeah. I got kids and stuff too now. Maybe when they're older and I can play with
it.
Them.
Yeah, because you need a lot of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My brother only plays video games when I come over, so. You know, and he's got two kids, so that's in a, yeah, I can see that trend.
Yeah, for sure.
So before we get into, you know, the Half-Life films, all that stuff, give everybody a quick one-minute bio of who you are and, you know, and what you do.
So I'm from England originally. Came out to film school early 2000, mid-2000. Did my film school thing, then realized I couldn't stay in the U.S. I mean, I knew I would be able to stay in the U.S., but worked on getting that status that I needed in 2005. Moved out to Los Angeles to do my, you know, to have a go. I made a few films, worked on a few films, and then got tempted up north to work in the video game industry, and worked for many years on a big multi-platform MMO in the video, you know, scene still, but for, you know, for a publishing house. And then decided that was, you know, not what I wanted to do, and came back down to LA and having a second go at the film industry again. And so, yeah, just wanted to make films and good, you know, good shows again, like before. So maybe I got a little burned out the first time, but that's kind of the short story.
And how long have you been back in LA?
This will be since 2015, end of 2015.
Okay. So coming up on 3 years.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been good.
Can you say the name of the game that you were working on before?
Yeah, it was, well, a bunch of games under the Wargaming banner. World of Tanks, World of Warplanes, World of Warships.
Oh, okay.
For
cool.
console, too. It's a big game.
Is that the game that Arnold Schwarzenegger did commercials for?
I don't think so.
Oh,
that was a mobile
one.
Game, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, that would cool. have been great, but for those guys. But it's nice. Like, it's like a game that's so big in Europe and so big in Russia. It's like that. It's, you know, it's synonymous. Like Apple is synonymous here. They just, everybody knows it. It's just not so huge in the US.
So can we rewind back to film school? Where did you go to film school?
I went to Full Sail in Winter Park, Florida.
Oh, that's a good one.
Okay. What's yeah. that like? I've never heard of that one.
They've got film schools all over. I think there's one in LA called the LA Film School. When I went there, it was still like more of a recording arts school, but it's like a technical school. I got a technical degree because I went to school in England first, got my degree there in business before I knew what I wanted to do, because I come from like a little village in the middle of nowhere, and it's not the LA thing is that's a million miles away. That doesn't
so
make any sense.
How did yeah. you get into film then?
I was vacationing in Florida with my parents, and we just saw the school, and they were like, "What do you want to take a look?" And that was it. I was not going back because they had a really good sales pitch, and it was like, you know, come and play on Panavision cameras and learn about lighting and making movies. And yeah, it was a very slick sales pitch. But I'm, you know, I got a good education. I made the most of it. You could, you know, you could just do pretty much nothing and cruise through. But you could, you know, I took all the other classes that I didn't pay for. You know what I mean? Like, I went to the digital media courses and game design. And if you knew the instructors, they just let you sit in. So I probably got like a, you know, double the education.
Yeah. And then what was the dream after you graduated film school and you came to LA? What were you hoping was going to happen?
Well, make a feature film. I wanted to make a feature film by the time I was 25, but I didn't get to LA until I was 25, you know, because of my legal status of being an immigrant and not having a green card. I couldn't work and stuff. So after that, you know, it's like, it's just, it's very different than you imagine it's going to be. You know, I should have spent the money that I spent on film school on just making a film, and I would have been able to knock that one off right away.
Yeah.
But you just don't know that. So
I want to interject really quickly, because I just worked with somebody on Monday who his big thing was to make his first feature before he was 30.
Yeah.
And like, he did everything in his power, spent tons of money, raised all this money, made his movie. And he was like, yeah, he was talking about how important that was for him to make it before he turned 30. And, you know, I think I can relate to that a little bit. Like, I used to feel like, oh, I need to be faster and making my movie sooner. But what I've learned, especially through doing this podcast, is that it really doesn't matter.
No. You know, it's just something when you're young.
You just make it when you can make it, you know.
When you're young,
it's an arbitrary deadline you set in yourself to, like, achieve some sort of level of status that you want to get to. Because you look at a lot of the filmmakers that we admire and respect, and they did it when they were really young.
Yeah.
So you think that that's the way to do it.
Yeah. I think now it makes more sense to try to find the group of people that you're going to go on that journey with versus actually making a film and make lots of little things, because, you know, those really successful, or at least the filmmakers that I think that I want to emulate or have looked up to, make the same movie essentially, or a similar movie with the same few people, the same producers, the same you know, keys that they've gone from when they made like the first sub-million-dollar film all the way to, you know, multi-hundred-million-dollar movies. And so I think, like, that should be the focus. At least they don't teach that in film school, but find that group of people that are really awesome, because you're not going to be able to do it without them, because you just go from film to film. Otherwise, like, people's relationships burn out, or they don't, you know, they don't work well together. And to try to keep making it with people you just don't get along with or aren't perfectly, it's like a marriage or whatever. You've just got to be married to all these people for, you know, for a long time. So I've tried to focus on, since I came back, on getting a group of people together that you could really make something great with versus actually just making a film.
Yeah, the collaboration part of it is so huge. And I feel like when you collaborate with somebody who you really work well with, and then you work with somebody else who maybe it's not that same situation, you really realize how important those good collaborations are, you know, and sticking with those people. So, Ian, or unless Timothy, do you have any other non-Half-Life related questions you
want to? Yeah, I just wanted to ask one last question. Was, now that you kind of, you left LA and then you came back, I'll just say, like, lived a little bit more life, in hindsight, what would you have done differently having graduated film school and gone to LA to, like, make your dreams come true?
That's a good question. I mean, well, I guess, like I said, in hindsight, I looked for a different group of people. I went through the process of working on several movies from beginning to end or midway through to the end, and just stuck it out and tried to make the best movie that I could, even though you knew that movie was never going to be good and it was doomed. So I think I probably would have been a bit more selfish and moved on to other projects, or tried to find those people that I think that were, you know, that were better. And, you know, networking is such a big part of it. You just don't, if you're not a good networker, you know, if you're not good at talking to people, it can be a real, can be a real drag as well, because so much of it, so much of your connection, or all of your connection, just comes from working on stuff. So if you only work on two things for 3 years, you just don't meet people.
Right.
You know, you really want to be working on as many things as you can possibly work on. I probably should have done that. I should have tried to have gone on sets as PAs, and I think, and try to work more, and met some people. That might have been better, because now the relationships that I have, that I still work with, are people that I, you know, that I met all that time ago, that I've maintained those relationships with. So
I think that's kind of, for me, is what film school is about too.
Yeah.
And probably the main reason to go to one of the bigger film schools is because a lot of those people will enter the industry, especially if you go to a film school in LA.
Yeah.
You just know, just by nature of being in LA, people will graduate and get into the industry. And you'll know all those people.
Yeah. It's a great point. Almost nobody came out to LA from the class that I was in.
Yeah, and same with me. I went to school in San Francisco, and there's a few people that graduated that I now like see around, but not very many people from my school actually like enter the industry. I've just never heard from them again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a good one. Go to a big film school that's in LA. Like, it's never, right. never really heard that before, but it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Most people get their jobs from people they met in college, friends that they, you know, later in life, you know, oh, look, I got this role. Hey, come work with me. I mean, I worked in the game industry, and it was because of a friend that I knew that was like, hey, I'm a general manager of this place. Come and help us build it up. And that was it. I'm like, okay, that sounds like an amazing opportunity.
Yeah, that's how it works.
You know, if he'd been in the film industry, you know, who knows what I could have been working on. It just, you know, to you know.
Yeah.
So let's step into the Half-Life world. Like, at what point did you decide that you wanted to make, and I guess right now they're episodes, but did you want to make episodes or did you just want to go make one film and then it turned into something bigger?
Probably originally we just did it. We did it for fun. I wanted to probably make a film. When I originally pitched it to Bernard, who plays the main character, it was just like, you know, you look like this guy, you know, it's a very popular game, or it was, it's a cool character. Let's make a little, you know, proof of concept thing. And then maybe it turns into something else. Maybe we can get a series made, or maybe Valve would be interested in, you know, and doing something. You have high hopes for it. But I think it was just kind of it was a conversation that we never really expected it to happen. And then we, I found a mask, one of the creatures in the game is like this gruesome head, you know, was a head crab zombie. And I found an artist online, a famous VFX artist that had made one of these things for his son as a Halloween costume. And I'm like, well, if I reach out to him through MySpace, this is how long ago it was, MySpace.
This is 2012?
Yeah. He just didn't have a Facebook page. The only way I could get a hold of him was through MySpace, because it's kind of a closed world, that world. And so I had to like resurrect my MySpace account or set up a MySpace account. And I emailed him or mailed him through MySpace, and I wasn't ever expecting to get a reply. I was like, you know, if you could you pull me another mold from this from this mask or whatever, la da da da. And he just wrote back, yeah, sure, I'll do it.
Oh, that's cool.
Charge you for the latex or whatever. And so then it became kind of like a real thing, and that was it. We just kind of moved forwards, and then I had to make a suit and stuff. And
wow.
And then we realized, you know, there was no money. We just put a couple of $1,000 of our own money in and made it in a location that we knew we had access to, where we weren't going to get any trouble from.
Why, I guess you probably didn't think too deeply about it, but why did you choose to go after somebody else's property rather than like creating your own from the ground up?
Because there's just a built-in fan base. Like, people will watch it. If we'd made something that our own, it'd have like 1,000 views. You know, or whatever. And it could be 10 times or 20 times as good, and people just don't.
Were you ever worried that Valve would be like, guys, you guys can't, as soon as it's up, like want you to take it down or anything?
Not really. I mean, I did my research and looked at what they've done in terms of, you know, how they've responded to other, there was other fan films that were around at the time. And so it just, there was no chance that they were going to stop it. I mean,
what were some of the fan films you saw that you're like, oh, they did it, so why can't we do it?
There was one, there were several, I don't remember specifically, but there was one by a couple of brothers that was based on Half-Life 2. I think that was pretty cool. They were VFX guys or commercial guys or something, and they'd done it. And I showed that to Bernard, and I think I got that him to sort of take a bite based on how that looked. And, you know, that had got some views and stuff as well. And he was definitely some inspiration from other fan films at the time as well that were out there. Portal 1, Dan Trachtenberg one, I don't remember if that came before or after. But that was certainly well done.
It seemed like it was done in 2011, but his rise to direct Cloverfield didn't happen for a few years after that. So you probably didn't know like how successful that short would have been, even if you had heard of it.
Yeah. The views on that video on YouTube are definitely a bit fishy. They when I was at Machinima.
The Portal film?
Yeah. When I was at Machinima, because we got hooked up with Machinima, and I'll tell you guys how in a minute, but the guy up there that we spoke to, that was the, you know, that was a content guy, that, you know, that arranged to get things on said that, you know, that was that 20 million views or 10 million views in such a short amount of time, there's just no way that it wasn't artificially created.
And really?
But, you know, like, not in a bad way, in a good way, because he just... Because the film was good, so you took a film and then you gave it 10 times the views or 5 times the views or twice the views. Or it could be all legit, I don't know for sure. But that just creates even more of a, you know, of a calling card. Like, you can go to agencies and you can say, look at the views, this is insane. And, you know, really get yourself a feature. So, you know, I would definitely look into artificially inflating views on a video.
Right.
You know, I know we even talked about doing it on the third episode of just paying, you know, $3,000 and blowing it up to like 10 million views just to, because most people don't know that you can do that really still.
Yeah. I've heard that on a few podcasts that people talk about, you can just pay for views, you know, and if you, and subscribers too, you know, on Twitter and stuff.
Yeah.
And
it's just about money.
Yeah, you can do that, but there's also like a difference between paid ones and organic ones, you know, but it's really hard for like the average person to tell.
They can't tell.
So, well, okay, well, here, I have a few more questions. Just, I know we already talked about like why you came up with it, but it was basically like, you're a fan of the game, you saw some other fan films out there, you're like, okay, well, let me just talk to Bernard, this actor that you knew, who kind of looked like Gordon Freeman a little bit, right? And then, was he a fan of the game? Had he heard of it before? Or did you have to, like, really convince him?
I had to really convince him. He wasn't a gamer. I had to sit him down and show him and play and stuff. I think the main thing about it was just how much of a dead ringer he was for, like, that art from the second Half-Life game. I mean... If you put glasses on him, and it was just, he just was the spitting image. It was almost like the guy that drew it had based it on Bernard. It was that close. Right. Like, we didn't really have to do anything to him except put glasses on him and he grew a goatee. You know, it's like, he even has the same slender build and the whole thing. So I was just like, you know, there's no one else out there that's going to be, you know, that's going to look and embody that character kind of in the same way that you're going to do it. So we should definitely do it. And then I just worked on him and convinced him. And then we got the mask and I started to make the suit. And so he started to see it coming together. And we'd recently worked on something together. I didn't know Bernard for that long before that. And so there was some convincing, but I think really just because of what a, you know, how much he looked like the Gordon Freeman character was really the inspiration.
So when you made the first one, so you made the suit yourself, you just made that by hand basically? It's pretty impressive.
It looks
great.
The first one I didn't was not great, or it wasn't, you know, just didn't have the experience. But for the second film, I spent a lot more time on it and did a lot more research on it. I actually, Steve Wang, who was the guy that created the mask, gave me a lot of input and tips and stuff as well. So, and that's a relationship that I, you know, that I got through this process that that I still have. That's a working relationship. Like, we've worked together, and he, you know, we even just went and shot the Vortigaunt portion for the final episode, the puppet that he, you know, he made, you know. So, like, he's another gamer that just loves to make cool shit and be involved. And, you know, if I ever make a film where we need some, you know, some incredible, you know, some incredible models or puppets, or, I mean, they're even doing 3D print. They're doing wild shit over in his studio, but, you know, he's like a, you know, he's like the guy that designed the Predator monster, like a legendary.
Oh, what, the original Predator monster?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, like was Stan Winston?
Yeah, he was the guy at Stan Winston's shop that put that together.
Wow, that's amazing. Wow, what a amazing person to run into through making a movie.
Dude, you wouldn't believe it. Yeah, he's an unbelievable character. You wouldn't believe it. Yeah.
That's awesome. So then when you made the first film, did you shoot everything separate? Did you shoot them all like episode 1, episode 2, episode 3, or did you shoot it all together? Like, how did you guys do the shooting?
The first one we shot by itself. It was very much like a low budget, you know, all your friends and whatever in a cottage in Hollywood for 2 days over a weekend, and that was it. And so then we just cut it together, and I started my sort of visual effects. I was already into visual effects from being in school, but then I sort of really had to get into compositing and understanding visual effects to finish it. So I essentially just sat with it for a few months myself and on the side and worked with it. And then the second and third film parts of the series, obviously, were after the Kickstarter and the Indiegogo, which came later. We took the first episode to Machinima, or I'll tell you the Machinima story. Bernard was just talking about the film in a restaurant, and somebody came and tapped on his shoulder and said, "Hey, I work for Machinima. That sounds like a really interesting project. Here's my card. Why don't you come and see us?" Like, that's how kind of small world it is.
That's pretty
here
crazy.
In LA. Yeah. So if you talk loud enough in as many, you know, in enough places, someone's going to come and talk to you.
That's awesome.
So I actually live like a couple of blocks away from Machinima. So we just walked down there and we showed the video to the guy. And the guy was like, "I thought this was going to be shit. This is fucking unbelievable. We definitely want to put this on Machinima. We're going to take it." And then, you know, we started to get into all the conversations about how they want to do a series and this, and they were going to finance all this stuff. And so we wrote, you know, we wrote, it had incredible ratios. When they dropped it on Machinima, the feedback ratio to view ratio and the comment ratio was like in the 99th percentile. So
wow,
it really fit that audience, I guess, or people really dug it, I guess. And so they got really excited about it, but they were doing other things with studios and, you know, and they didn't actually really pay for anything over there. They rope in the IP owners and stuff and get them to pay for it. And, you know, Valve was never going to be into anything like that.
Oh, so their plan was not to finance it themselves, but to, like,
yeah,
go to Valve and be like, "Look how great this is and how much traction it is. Let's make a whole series." And yeah, you just need to put in,
yeah,
you know, $500,000 or something.
Yeah, I think that was it. No, I never got confirmation of that, but, I mean, that was what they did with the other things and, you know, other studios at the time, and they did other stuff. And, you know, Valve, it was just like, you know, like it is with everything else, they're just silence. They don't care.
Right.
They're making games on a platform, you know, for people to play games. And so,
yeah,
they're like happy to let you do it, but they're not going to bankroll it. Then later on, the talk with J.J. Abrams about making Portal films and Half-Life films all happen. But, you know, Star Wars and all that, it could be forever.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So Star Wars and Star Trek, and then, you know, it's like even Portal now is pretty aged, you know. It's not,
it seems like no one's really interested in bringing these properties to life because there's a bigger audience in Marvel movies and Star Wars and Star Trek. Just
would take somebody that really cared, like a Blade Runner type situation, you know, Sony kind of just pulling out all the stops and really supporting that project regardless of whether it was going to make a huge amount of money or not, and then letting
it be. The big adaptations that you hear about, like we've been hearing about an Uncharted movie for years and years, and that hasn't happened yet, you know. And we've been hearing about a Last of Us movie, and that hasn't happened yet either, you know. And it's like those are like the AAA most popular games that are out right now, and those aren't happening. So like, why would a game from years and years that the sequel keeps on teasing us with Half-Life 3 and then it never happens, and teasing us with Half-Life 3 and then now it's like probably never going to happen at all, and you're like, oh, so that game's going to get made into a movie? Probably not, you know.
It's probably not a thing. But it was, you know, inspirational at the time, and, you know, Machinima wanted to put it out there, and so we wrote like a whole season of stuff and like an outline for a whole series of I think it was 10 episodes, me and Bernard, and then it just kind of dwindled away. And so we did the Kickstarter and the Kickstarter and the Indiegogo thing, and we you know, we had high hopes and put it on Indiegogo, and it was just a complete failure.
Oh, no.
In terms of what we wanted to raise. And then, you know, we asked the Indiegogo folks, we're like, "Look, do you want us to try to make it for this amount of money, or should we try to do another, you know, fundraiser?" And everybody was like, raise more. So we tried to raise more, and we raised about an equal amount again. And it's not a lot of money. I think it was something around 40K in total.
That's a 20K the first time and 20K the second
time? Yeah, pretty much.
And how much were you asking for?
I forget now. I think 50 both times or something like that.
I'm on the Indiegogo page and you're asking for 75,000.
Yeah, there we go, 75K. So Indiegogo was a failure. And then,
but come on, let's just pump the brakes here for a second, Ian. $20,000 is a lot of money to raise on crowdfunding. And, you know, like,
just saying he didn't reach his goal.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm just saying that's a lot. You know, like a lot of movies don't even ask for more than 15,000 or even 10,000 these days. And then if they get over that, then they're really excited. Like, I just saw one from last fall that was like 20K and they think they got like 21, you know? And, you know, I guess you do still see the people who are asking for 100,000 or 200,000 and sometimes they get them and sometimes they don't. But I feel like people, you know, around 20,000 to raise on crowdfunding is pretty good. And the fact that you did two and you got 40, like, I mean, I know that's not your goal and everything, but still, like, that's a pretty great number.
I think it was more like, In the fact that the awareness of it was a failure. Like, even now I still see people post things like, oh my God, they should crowdfund this, you know? If I'd somehow been able to get a link into that Machinima video, you know, when it originally dropped, I mean, I probably would have raised 100, 200 plus thousand because people would have just put a couple of bucks down after they watched that in the excitement. But I could only reach a tiny percentage of those people that watched it. And so from that perspective of not of thinking that it would snowball and that people would just share it, that was a failure, you know, like you really needed to be much more strategic about how you targeted all those people and have a real plan. And and so from that perspective, true. And, you know, 20,000 or 40,000, whether it's a lot of money, but not to make a film with that type of content.
That's
you
true.
Know, you've got props, you've got weapons, you've got suits, you've got, you know, a number of people, you've got monsters, and I just promised way too much in terms of what we were going to do for people and what we were going to show. Because, you know, the thing about crowdfunding is you actually have to deliver. If you're going to be honest and true, you got to deliver all that shit that you promise. And just the shipping alone costs thousands of dollars to send all the stuff to people. So
I learned that the hard way on my Kickstarter. So,
To mention the federal government comes after you after a few years and is like, oh yeah, by the way, that $40,000, we want our
That's portion. Income. I know that shocked me when, like, the year that I raised money for my film and I raised like $96,000 and then I got tax forms and I was like, whoa, what?
Yeah.
So the government thinks that I just made like $96,000. Yeah. No, that's not the case. I'm spending this on a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. We all found out that the hard way, the early people that adopted it. So, so really $40,000 is more like $20,000. When you've put the money aside for all the perks and whatnot,
and stuff.
It was just a stupid idea to try to do all that stuff for $20,000.
Yeah, do your math, people.
Yeah. So did you take that you know whatever it ends up being $20,000, $40,000 whatever you had, and that's what you put into the second two episodes?
Yeah, I just spent that on production.
Wow,
because you know locations and like making the suit the second time around was not a cheap process either, because you got to buy all that material and paint and the whole thing. So all the electronics, you know, I had to buy all the weapons, lots of other things that I can't think of right now, but you know, just insurance, like I couldn't go, by that time, you know, my friends, the people that were in it the first time had more established careers, and then they're like members of SAG and stuff, and now this thing's got a million views, and they're like, well, we can't do it if it's not SAG or if we're not insured, because if we get hurt, we're working in a power station. The power station guy's like, don't put your hands over your head or you could get electrocuted. You know, so you got to have insurance, and insurance costs money.
Yeah,
locations cost money. So suddenly it's like, it's just what are you thinking? And that's before you even get into the visual effects, and it's massively visual effects heavy. And that's really where the time's gone.
You know,
once we decided to do it in 4K and deliver all the visual effects in 4K.
Whoa, really?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, basically, what happened is I just had to put it on hold, essentially, for several years while I worked up north. And then when I came back, I'm like, you know, I'd met some good guys. And I'm like, we can finish making this film. We essentially had to start a visual effects company to support ourselves doing post and visual effects so that we could work on the film on the side when we're not.
Wow.
Yeah. So
that's crazy.
When I came back to LA 3 years ago, I started a VFX post-production company, and then there's three of us that are partners, and two of us worked while the other one just worked, or one of us constantly worked on the film all the time while the other supported the one
by doing freelance jobs and stuff.
Yeah, basically.
So let's go back in time again a little bit, because like I just as a fan and someone who, you know, does like looks at movies and makes movies or whatever. Like I said, you released on Machinima in 2012.
Yeah.
And that was called Half-Life Enter the Free Man.
Yeah.
So then you had a name change, Half-Life The Freeman Chronicles.
Yeah.
And then you released it on your own platform.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit and then like why you didn't just go back to Machinima to release episode 2?
Because you just can't access any of those people on Machinima, you know? So you have all these people that view it, and the views are nice. But once you've got that, like, now you're just giving them free content because you're just going to have another video with a bunch of views that you can't actually access the people that view it. And so I was like, you know, even if it gets a few thousand views, at least there'll be people that subscribe to our channel and we'll be able to reach them again. And we can grow it, you know, from that perspective. So I just went that route for that reason. I talked briefly to the guys at Rocket Jump about putting it out with them, but it just never went anywhere.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, because Timothy and I have had pretty good success releasing some of our movies on CG Bros YouTube channel.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, you know, it's like, yeah, it's on their channel. They're getting the ad money from it. They're getting the views on there, and they're getting the subscribers. But, you know, for us, it's like our movie gets the views, yeah, right? And then we get the feedback from all the comments, and we get the interaction with the fans because we can just jump on YouTube and talk to them. So, you know, maybe we're not tapping into that fan base as far as, like, you know, them following our careers necessarily. But at least it's like they're following the movie, which is nice, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, it's part of me would have put it on Machinima so more people saw it. But then, you know, once I was like, there's Valve legitimately could be on Steam, I'm like, that's kind of where I want it to live, really more than YouTube at all. And so that's, you know, that's kind of the goal for me at this point, is to get it as a little series on Steam, and then it can just live there in, you know, in perpetuity as like a gift to the you know, those gamers that played that game and enjoy watching film.
Nice. So, and then just, you know, this is kind of going around everywhere, but with Steam, do they give you a count of how many views you get, or is that all just secret?
You know what? I do think they do. I could look it up.
Yeah, because I went onto Steam. I didn't, because I have a Steam account. I didn't actually log into my Steam account and looked. I just looked on Steam on my computer really quickly on my laptop, and I saw that there's a stats button, but when I push the stats button, it just takes me to your website, you know?
Right.
But yeah, I would love to know what those numbers are, because gosh, Steam is really, really huge and really popular, and the Half-Life fans, it's insane. Like, me and my wife are playing Half-Life 2 again right now on Steam and loving every second of it, you know?
Yeah, it's a great game.
It's so good. And so, and like, you know, people are just insanely like obsessed with this franchise. So I feel like Steam's probably the perfect place because that's where all those nerds are, you know?
Yeah. It's buried right now under like a million other videos. That's the thing. So it doesn't get any, it doesn't get a great deal of action now. When it initially dropped on there, it's at the top of that list for a while, like new releases or whatever. I got a lot of action, but now people don't see it and they're not promoting it internally.
Right.
So, you know, it's just, it's actually minimal in terms of the actual views that it's getting. But I mean, I'd like to think that when I drop the third episode, I'm going to drop it on Steam first. And I'm going to just write them an email and say, hey, guys, can you promote this? This is the final chapter. And maybe I'll get some love.
And maybe I won't. That'd be cool.
Yeah.
So did you just see the view count? Like, do they give you a total view count, or is it just like a weekly view count or something?
You know what? I'm going to try to log in while I'm online right now, but I haven't. Okay. I don't get like reports or anything like that.
I have to go
find it.
And you're obviously not getting any money from them of any kind, right?
No.
All right. So and you did your Kickstarter, your crowdfunding, was that all in 2012 and 2013, or was that later?
Yeah, both around the same time.
Okay, cool. And then
one question about that. Was that to raise money for a second episode or for a feature-length version of it?
For a series. We said we were going to try to complete what we'd started out with Machinima, but then when there was a lot less money, we scaled it back and said, well, we'll do a few episodes instead. And we checked in a lot with the people that, you know, that submitted money, and we did like polls to check the people, like what they wanted us to do, and should we
what are you expecting from us?
Yeah, and they were okay with it, and so we, what, you know,
so what did you finally agree to with the money that you raised from those?
I think it was just one more episode. Okay. And then we decided to make it a double, because once we shot it, there was enough footage for, you know, for two sort of equally length episodes that were sort of similar in length to the first. And so there was a good spot to cut it in half, because it was initially just going to be one long episode.
Yeah.
But then I'm like, you know, there's a good spot to cut it right here. Let's just cut it, and then we can get this out first and give people
something. Give them a number two, and then we can spend some more time on the last one.
Yeah. And the third one is so visual. There's so many. There's a visual effect in every shot, and it's everything's...
You know, and are you done with the third one?
I would say it's about 95% complete.
So it hasn't come out yet.
No.
That's next.
It's got to go through sound and whatnot. So,
but once episode 3's out, that's the end of this journey for now.
That's it, yeah.
Until you think of the next thing.
Yeah, yeah. Until somebody comes knocking, we're not going to go pursue anything related to Half-Life or anything. It just, it's been a labor of love, you know. There's a lot of people that are okay with you taking your time, but there's an awful lot of people that are really pissed off and upset that they didn't get their...
Yeah, I did. On my Kickstarter, I think when I did my Kickstarter campaign, you had to say that you were going to deliver it within a year of the campaign ending.
Yeah.
That there wasn't a choice to extend it. So I told everyone my movie was going to be done in a year. It took me 4 years. And I would say in those last few years, there were people that would write me nasty things on Kickstarter, either in the comic section or sometimes even just directly to me through Kickstarter and just say, where's my movie? I think you stole my money, kind of things. And then if I looked at like who they actually were, sometimes it would just be people that gave like $20.
Yeah, or $1. I would say it's usually $5 or $1 are the people that are really pissed at me.
Yeah, which is always kind of surprising to me. It's not like they're the ones that invested a lot.
Yeah.
But they seem to be the ones that cared the most.
Yeah. Most of our investment came from people that invested a lot. There was like a few hundred in middle of the road, but there was several large donations where people were just like, fucking Half-Life, I love it. And they've got disposable income and they just dropped like...
Were they pretty supportive during the process? Were they, or did any of those people get mad at you?
One got mad, but our biggest supporter is just some guy that I never heard from again that didn't want credit, that, you know, that sort of vanished. It was he's the strangest of all. Like he put down probably like a quarter of the budget and then was like, he was never heard from again. Wow. Like maybe it was some guy with his like mom or dad's credit card and or whatever, I don't know, but I really don't know. Like, it's just a guy, all I've got is a first name, and I just thanked him in the credits by his first name, and that was it.
Wow. And you're never able to contact him later and you know, interact with this person? And yeah, because that's like, you know, I've heard some cool stories of people getting a big you know, like whatever, person through Kickstarter, like Kickstarter backer putting down a big amount of money on a movie, and then like later becoming like an executive producer on future projects or you know, and that's like the dream, right? But I certainly haven't had that happen, you know.
No, I mean, this is as close to that. I just couldn't find the guy. Like, I tried to find him on Facebook, I tried to search his email, he was just non-existent online, and so I have no idea. So it's like, thanks Chris or thanks Rich or something in the first credits, and that's it. That's all I could do,
because
he specifically requested no credit, not like an executive producer credit or anything. So, but I just didn't want to not put a special thanks or something, so I just put it at the end, like at the very end, so as not to insult the person and give them a credit when they'd asked specifically not for one. But I also felt like, Jesus, you know.
Yeah, like, you gotta get some recognition here, right?
Yeah, I hope you realize how much difference that made, you know. So
yeah. Anyway. So going back to that time, so when did you actually release the second episode?
Not that long ago, last year.
Oh wow, so it was basically like 2012 and then all the way to like 2016, 2017 when you released episode 2.
Yeah, because we raised the money and then I'd moved, and then getting everybody together in the same city at the same time became a real thing, because Bernard was now working on things. Like, he worked on a couple of Amazon shows. He was on a couple of big shows. And so when you have a part on a show, they they put you under a contract and you can't change your appearance and you can't, you know, you can't take other shows and do other things. And so he couldn't cut his hair or change the way that he looked for Freeman because he needed to look the way that he was going to look if he suddenly got called back to be, you know, to be on the show again. And so it just took a long time to organize everybody's schedules. And then we had this one window, like, I think it was 2013, where we could all get together in LA and shoot at the same time. So we went for it, and then I just tried to get everything ready in time and make new props and things. I spent like 6 months building the new suit and all the other, you know, props and things that were needed, and organizing locations and actors and stuff, because there's a bigger cast and crew, a much bigger cast and crew for the two episodes.
Oh yeah, it grew a lot when you went to two and three.
Yeah, there was three cast members, or four cast members in the first one, and that was it. And then the crew was, you know, four people: me holding a camera, somebody holding a boom or whatever. But for the second one, there was 30 plus people.
Wow.
You know, on set and involved to wrangle a power station and, you know, all the military guys and then, you know, a proper villain and then the main, you know, the main group that's with Freeman. So
nice. Awesome. Yeah.
Makeup guys wrangling somebody to wrangle the suit, you know, because when you're running around in this crazy suit, you know, it breaks and stuff, so you gotta have somebody dedicated to that,
to repairing it and making sure it looks good and all that. Wow.
You know, makeup and smoke effects and all that shit makes it such a difference to the way that it looks in terms of overall, you know, production value. So
wow. So then you shot, so that was two and three that you guys shot in 2013.
Yeah.
And then you're doing the visual effects. You finally get it done for the first one, and now you're working on getting the final one done. And, I mean, how soon do you think this will actually come out? Do you, like, will a third episode be out in, like, a couple weeks, like a month?
A couple of months. We're working on a show right now for YouTube Red. We do, like I said, we've got this post facility now, so we're kind of inundated right now, which is a good thing, obviously, with business. And so we had to move into a new office, and then this show kicks off now, and it's just getting over the hump of editorial into visual effects, so we can start to put some time back onto that as well. And it's kind of like the same as last year. We had the same show last year. We did previous seasons of this show, and so you know, we're sort of able to plan around it and sort of in the same release schedule, hopefully. But I just, at this point, like, to try to rush it out, like, it just doesn't, I'd rather just spend a bit longer and make it the way we want to make it. So
yeah, but it's perfect.
Yeah, it's, well, not perfect, but it's right around the corner.
Perfection is an illusion.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I mean, to take out all the, to basically just smooth off all the you know, the lumps and things, you know what I mean, as much as you can. So and I think it, you know, I think it's a cool final episode. It's a great way to end it, and you know, and like I said, it landed up on Steam, so it all kind of came around, which is nice.
And then what's next?
Well,
have you started thinking about it?
Yeah, I mean, we're just developing our own stuff now because we have this business that, you know, is here and can sustain a little bit. So
the name of your company is Chariot Drive?
Yeah.
We know somebody that works there.
Oh yeah?
Zeke.
Oh yeah, you guys know Zeke?
Yeah, Zeke did some portal effects for a music video that Ulrich and I shot last year.
Oh really?
Yeah, and he was a fan crazy of the show when he was in the Bay Area, and then yeah, I reached out to him about doing visual effects for this music video, and then he's like, yeah, I moved to LA, I'm working for this place called Chariot Drive.
Holy shit, I had no idea. I didn't even mention this to him, but I bet if I had, he'd probably be sitting here right now and telling you all about other visual effects shit. No, that's fine. He's been working on. Yeah,
he been doing a lot of the Half-Life stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
I mean, he probably did 75% of the visual effects in the second episode while we did other stuff. Yeah,
that's awesome.
He's actually an owner, a partner. He owns part of the company.
Oh really? Oh, really? Cool. That's awesome.
I can't believe it. That's so crazy. I've probably seen the music video you guys are talking about.
Yeah, it's what's it called, Timothy?
We Have to Escape by Beautiful Machines. It's like three band members kind of in this big train station building this machine.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, or I saw some effect shots from it or something like that.
Yeah, that's so cool. It hasn't come out yet.
Very small world.
It's all done and it's like sitting there and ready to be released, but what the band is trying to find the right way to release it.
Right. Well, yeah, that's cool.
I think we met Zeke originally through the podcast. Is that right, Timothy?
Yeah, I think I feel like he reached out to us through the podcast, like over Twitter, and then he ended up doing visual effects on a local film here because I introduced him to the filmmakers, and then I met him for the first time at the screening of that film. But yeah, I think he's a super talented dude. Like, I was always impressed with the stuff that he was doing. I think Ulrich and you and I watched some of his short films too and commented.
Yeah, yeah, I watched a few of his shorts. Yeah. Some cool stuff. Really good effects. You know?
Yeah, he and I are like working on all kinds of different projects together right now. We've got several scripts and concepts in development, and he's got some feature that he wrote. Actually, I took that feature to AFM you were talking about earlier.
Oh, really? Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. So, yeah, why were you at AFM?
Well, because I'd never been before, for one, just to see what it was like and to sort of get the feel for it, you know, and have what to expect and to put a package together. And I was coming off vacation, and so it just felt like the right time to go and check it out. And I wanted us to use the Freeman stuff plus a script that we'd written or that Zeke wrote with a friend of his and see if we could combine the two together. Like, here's the look of the film and the quality level of the visuals, and it's backed up by a visual effects company, and here's the script we want to make, you know. But it kind of works, but people just will go, well, where's your feature, you know? And you're like, wow, it's kind of like a feature. It's just a really short version of a feature compacted with hundreds of visual effects or whatever. But so I wasn't having a great deal of luck. It's like people want a feature in that, you know, and a proof of concept. So, you know, we kind of have decided to kind of develop something smaller, you know, and do a feature on a smaller budget sort of internally ourselves, just so that we have it. And then take a bunch of projects to Toronto or AFM or maybe Cannes or something at a future time with a feature. And then we'll have a series of decks. You know, I told Ulrich a little bit about this, a series of decks of, you know, concepts that we want to do attached to scripts, maybe even package up some talent and some stuff like that as well, you know, with this high concept, you know, visual effects piece that we've done, and as well as having done some feature length project as well. So we have high hopes for the next couple of years and where it's going to take us.
Did you have any luck at AFM?
I started really late, so I didn't have a great deal of previous appointments and things set up. Like, I think AFM's a lot about starting early and reaching out to companies and getting appointments so you can get like official sit down time. Like, I got a few walk-ins, but it wasn't a great experience, I would say, in terms of walk-ins. Like, I don't know, maybe I've not got the face for it, but I got a lot of like,
walk-ins are tough, man. I did a bunch of walk-ins and I got some people who you know, sat down with me or whatever, but yeah, it was not most of the walk-ins I did, it was like they might talk to me for five minutes or something.
Yeah.
But I didn't really get meetings a lot out of that, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and some of it was like, you know, like talking to a friend of mine who knew one of the other, you know, like production companies, and then them dropping my name and then me swinging by, and then I'm like, right. Oh yeah, Miles told me to come, you know, say hello. And he's like, oh yeah, Miles is great. Oh, awesome. And then like, okay, tell me what you got, you know, and then sitting down. So yeah, I mean, I think, you know, from my experience, like the meetings that went the best were the ones that were set up beforehand, you know?
Yeah.
But I feel like it's the same, what you just said. It's like everybody wants to see what feature you made and they want to see what distribution it got, or they want to know what actors you have attached to your project and they want to know that you're, you know, like either fully funded or like mostly funded.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
They didn't even seem to care if you're half funded. They're like, they just want it to be fully, they want to be able to like easily just say yes and then just go, you know. They don't really, didn't seem to care much about like if you were, you know, like working really hard or the amount of time you put into it. They just want it to be like a surefire bet, you know. Which is like, if you had all that stuff ready, you wouldn't even need the production company.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. What, I mean, are you guys insane? Like, what the heck's going on here?
It's the whole chicken and the egg thing. It's,
right.
It's got to be in the right place at the right time. But I think with enough projects, you know, like we really have this intention to have 5 or 6 decks. And I'll send you the deck that I showed to you at AFM. So, you know, things like that, maybe we can get some talent attached, maybe not. You know, and a feature and some high concept stuff. I mean, you just up your chances that somebody, you know, takes a chance on you, the more, you know, the more that you have. And if you've got 5 projects or a series or, you know, several series and several films, again, you just up your chances because they can say no to 1, they can say no to 2, they can say no to 3, and maybe you catch something. So,
right, exactly.
You know,
yeah,
it's that sort of plan. And, hopefully the company, and we've not been in business for that long, but hopefully the company's established enough that it can help support that process. That's the idea, is to support the filmmaking now through, you know, through something else versus all of us trying to individually make films and doing our day jobs. Like, we can come together and support each other, build this company, and at the same time it be an integral part of whatever films and productions we work on, you know, moving forward. It's kind of like a Peter, like a Weta for Peter Jackson, you know, like,
yeah,
start
right.
with a strong visual effects foundation where, you know, yeah, you can actually get the film finished.
It's so smart to create a business around your passion and that, yeah, like to support what you actually want to really do. I think to me, what you're doing is kind of like feeding into your dream and in such a great way that I hope everyone's listening to it and thinking about, all right, if I want to get to this point, what can I do that's going to sustain me as a human being? Let's pay my rent.
Yeah,
you know, buy me food, and then also gonna allow me to give me the resources to make my films.
Yeah, it really helps. We're working on stuff. It may not be exactly the types of things that we want to, but we're working on things. We're working in the industry. We're working with other directors, other producers, and other people. So you're meeting a lot more people, and
smart.
I wasn't doing that before. So,
and you have all the tools now too to help finish your own films.
Yeah, exactly. We can do visual effects for a fraction of the cost as if you have to go out and buy it. So, yeah, there's that. I was at Adobe Max a few years ago, and I saw Tim Miller, the guy that directed Deadpool, speak there, and he's the same thing. He's like a guy that has an animation shop, and he was just like a very down-to-earth dude and had like a lot of really cool things to say. I mean, he's just obviously super into comics and super into visual effects and animation, and then he just plugged away with this company for a while, and it afforded him eventually the platform and the opportunity to, you know, to make his dream project. And so there was some inspiration for us from that as well, or at least for me personally.
How do you start a company like that, though?
You have kids and you realize you've got no fucking choice because you've got to raise them. And so when you don't want to work for other people anymore, mm-hmm, you know, like, I just didn't want to work for other people. Like, I'd done the day job thing, I'd done the video game thing. And you're just lining other people's pockets with your great work. At least that's how it feels, you know? And so I'm like, you know, I've got to do this for myself.
How do you hustle to find those first gigs?
It's just the people you know, man. All our work comes through the people you know.
And what were the first things that you guys worked on as a company?
I came back down to LA and I met, you know, old friends and colleagues that I'd work with. And I met this one particular guy who's just a super awesome guy. You couldn't imagine. His name's Adam Lawson. And he was working on this. He was working on lots of shows. The guy hustles like you wouldn't believe. He's a scriptwriter and he's written tons of screenplays. And he's just been at it. He's super creative. And they had several things that they were working on, but this show for YouTube Red, Escape the Night, was about to go. And he's like, yeah, we need some sort of post solution. Maybe that's something you can get into. So it was just the right place, right time. And I'm like, you know, we'd done some commercials. I'd worked with some other people, and me and one of my partners had decided to just set up an LLC so that we could put the income through the LLC and for tax purposes be better than is individually being contractors. And then we could sort of establish this name. You know, the Chariot Drive name had already got some headway from Half-Life, and there was people following it on Facebook and stuff. So we just kept the name, and we were like, you know, we'll just go for it. There wasn't like a big master plan to start with. It was more like a place to start. But then
start with just that one project.
Yeah. And then, you know, we'd done some commercials for Sonos through another friend of mine and Apple. And then I did another thing, you know, just a few things here and there. And then this came along. And then, you know, we just span up all this editorial and visual effects. And we ended up doing something like 700 visual effects, I think, for the first season.
Wow.
And so, you know, we did season two, and then season three is what we're working on right now. And then all the other stuff that's come in between, that's fall off and people we've met and stuff. We do a lot of augmented reality work as well right now.
So and, just momentum, like the more things you do, the more momentum it builds and the phone just keeps ringing.
That's what it is. The more people you can work with, the more exposure you get. And if the work's good, then you can just, you know, you can rely on people, or you can call people up and say, hey, what are you working on right now? And yeah, that's the way it goes. So, and I've never been a good networker, so I've just been really lucky, you know.
Right.
I think it's just been luck at this point.
Well, you know, we met randomly, networking, right, as you'd say, so I guess you're not that terrible of a networker, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've tried to be better. It's like it's a thing you have to really try to do, you know, like that's a really hard thing to go and talk to people for some people, so.
I always just try, and I was actually at a lunch yesterday where I did a very bad job networking personally, so I'm definitely not, you know, the best, but I always just feel like it's just outstretching your hand and saying hello to somebody, you know, and just, like, if you're standing next to somebody and you don't know them, like, you can always just introduce yourself, you know, and I think that's always a good attitude to have towards it. It's just, it's not really about, don't think of it, I try not to think about it as it's networking. It's more like you're just talking, you're just chatting, you know, talking about your passion, you know? And for me, it's like when I'm in a room with a bunch of filmmakers, like sometimes it's overwhelming, like yesterday, but I feel like, you know, it's usually just a really fun experience. And I try to keep that in mind when I'm going to these things. It's just like, just have fun. And just talk about what you're doing and why you love it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's always an easy way. So I have a couple questions to wrap up our conversation about fan films. After this whole process, like, I'm sure there's a lot of people who listen to this who are thinking about doing fan films. Like, I know I've talked to a bunch of people who had ideas to do fan films and whatnot. What advice would you have for somebody who's going out there gonna do like a Last of Us fan film or something that's hot right now? Like, what advice would you have?
That's tough. I mean, make sure you've got the right amount of money. You know what you're getting yourself into, because you don't want to disappoint the fans that you're trying to, you know, that you're trying to make something for. And I think, like any kind of indie film, you've got to think on a much smaller scale. Like, what can you do in one location or one room or one thing that you can actually legitimately make high quality for the amount of money that you're going to raise? You know, now, like, there's such a business to raising money on Kickstarter and Indiegogo that you can actually hire people to put your campaign together, and they'll just take a portion of the money that they raise and that type of thing. So get like a pro that knows how to raise money as well. I know that I know people that have done it that have tried to raise money for tabletop games and things like that, where you just stand a much better chance if you go and find somebody that's already successfully raised. So I think find somebody that has got some experience doing it if you can. Otherwise, make sure you really fucking love it, because you're going to have to live with it. Like, I've been living with this now for a long time, and I think if you really just hated it, you just eventually just push to the side and never, you know, and never finish it. Like, Half-Life has a a longevity to it. You know what I mean? It, The Last of Us is a great game. It certainly won a lot of awards, but I don't know that I'd necessarily put in that. This wasn't like a groundbreaking, you know, title with one of the greatest characters of all time. Do you know what I mean? So you've always got that feeling of like you're working on something special because it's based on something really special. So not to say that I thought that, you know, that The Last of Us or whatever was a great game or whatever. But I, you know, I played through Half-Life and I probably played a little bit of The Last of Us. Before, you know.
Well, you know, I guess it also depends. Looks like The Last of Us is coming out with a new game, I think, this year or next year. So if that one does as well as the first one, then that'll help put it in the same level of Half-Life. But I mean, I feel like it's not necessarily fair because Half-Life is like, it's like the most popular like shooter probably of all time. I mean, maybe not even arguably. I mean, it is like
more than BioShock.
Yeah, it's more well known than BioShock for sure.
Valve just did something different that nobody had ever done before.
It was the first one. It was like the first like cinematic shooter that like spawned all cinematic shooters. You know,
before that it was Doom and Quake, and you're just running around shooting, killing everything to progress. And you know, this was like, I remember playing it and sitting down and being like, "What the fuck." This is unbelievable. And then you just played it from beginning to end.
Yeah, and it had like some light puzzles in it too. And then the way the game was like laid out was sort of different and more like exploratory and not just about action, you know. You could almost say it paved the way for games like, you know, Skyrim and stuff too, just in a lot of ways, because it was more of that. It's less about just killing everything and more about exploring this world and, you know, the universe building and all that stuff too, you know.
Story and the
Now I feel like I missed out.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the best games of all time, hands down, you know.
They did like a fan remake of it. I mean, you can still play it. These guys, these developers basically got together and remade the entire game in a more advanced game engine that Valve makes, and you can play it on Steam, and then they gave it away for free. I think they've worked something out with Valve now where you can buy it for a few bucks, but it's a better version of the original, so you can truly still have that experience, and it doesn't stand up to, you know, like your AAA, you know, experiences now. But you can see like what, like how fundamentally or how groundbreaking it was for the time.
Half-Life Source? Is that what it is?
No, it's called Black Mesa.
Black Mesa, okay. So that's what I should be looking for.
Yeah, all right, cool. It's like Half-Life 2 engine, but the original, And they tweaked it and redid all the voices. Like, you know, like I feel like this project was big, the making of a fan series, but these guys remade a whole game from the ground up. Like, all the textures, all the voices, like... It's unbelievable.
Wow. Yeah, I should play that because I'm replaying Half-Life 2 right now. We skipped Half-Life the original just because the graphics are so blocky. Yeah. But yeah, Black Mesa sounds like the ticket.
Yeah, dude, go back and play it. Just get it out of the way before you finish your Half-Life 2. It really sets it up. It really sets it up.
It's amazing
what people will do, fan films and stuff like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Obviously, it was a means to an end for them to develop something to get some exposure or whatever, but at the same time, like, you've got to really be committed to do it because you're doing it for nothing, and it's hundreds, thousands of hours, hundreds of people. I just couldn't even imagine.
Right. The other thing that you didn't mention that I think is worth citing, and I mean, maybe you just didn't really, this is just obvious to you, and maybe, you know, you didn't feel like mentioning it, but like one thing you did really well was you captured the property in a really great way. Like, you made the suit that looks like the suit. Like, you have a head crab monster that looks like the head crab monster from the game. You have the crowbar is a big part of the short, at least the first episode, you know. And it's like, you know, if you didn't have all those pieces, it's like those are the iconic pieces that make the game what it is and what people remember from the game. And you did a great job of incorporating all that stuff into your show, you know. So I think for people making fan films, like, you have to make sure to get those the most iconic parts of the game need to be in the series, or people are going to get pissed off. You know?
Yeah, that's true. Thanks for saying that. Yeah, that's definitely true. And it's again, but it's on that scale where you got to be able to do it for the budget that you've got. You know, like if you try to do too much, or if you try to cover so much ground, everything just kind of ends up looking mediocre. And, you know, also surround yourself with people that don't mind telling you when your stuff looks like shit. You know?
Right.
Because that's sometimes important. You just can't tell from looking at it for so long, or you're just completely disconnected from how, like, somebody from that's never seen this before might respond to it.
Yeah, you don't get defensive like, when somebody says this looks like shit.
Yeah, or if it looks hokey and you just can't see the hokiness of it. You know,
how do you start seeing it though? Even if somebody says like, "Hey, it looks hokey," are you like, "What part of it looks hokey?" Do you kind of dig in and try to figure out what it is? Or
yeah, maybe, or maybe that's just enough for you to admit it to yourself.
To
or
wake
maybe
up.
You just trust those people, and you're like, you know what, maybe that's the case, and you find something better, you know, from it. But you know, there's like I said, it's that like whole rounding everything and smoothing everything off. Like I think, like if you can hack away those little things. That just makes your project seem so much better, or not better, but that's not the right word, but, you know, like an overall better experience, because you weren't taken out of it by this little thing or that little thing, or why wasn't this there, or why was that there, or that looked weird, or that person's... Yeah. Like, if there was any bad performance in the thing, I just cut it out. Like,
right.
It didn't matter to me if it was breaking the story, like I would find a way around it. If there was some effect that didn't work or something, I just cut it out. Like I was brutal.
That's really great advice. And I mean, Timothy is kind of one of the best people in the world for that, because like he'll watch your work and he'll really get in there and nitpick hardcore. And I think that's helped me in a lot of cases with my own stuff. But
I'm glad to hear that. I just, you know, I hate when Ulrich says, "Hey, can you give me feedback on it?" I'm like, oh no, this is gonna
be brutal. I have to rip it apart.
Yeah, I feel like I'm never giving anybody feedback that's like, "This is really great. Good job." I always have some criticism.
If you gave that to people and that's what they wanted to hear, then they would be doing, you'd be doing them a disservice, and they'd be doing themselves a disservice. Like,
yeah, exactly.
I think that tough criticism is really what you need to be hearing. And Ian, just the fact that you are in that mindset and you're willing to kill those babies, I think that's really great, you know?
Yeah, you've got to be really brutal. And if you can find that level of trust, like if you guys have that level of trust where you know you can say that stuff to them, you know, like that's a really important thing in a partnership. A lot of people just won't say what they're thinking, or they won't really give it to you. Like my sister, she doesn't really work in this kind of industry in this way, but she would always, like I was always brutally honest with my sister, probably to a fault. And, you know, it probably didn't help in some situations, but if she really wanted to know what somebody thought of something or what it looked like she would only ask one person. Like, didn't matter, mom, dad, family or whatever. Like, she really wants to know the truth, you know? And I think that's really important in a relationship that you've got, especially in filmmaking. Like, how, you know, read this. What do you think? Oh, yeah, it's great.
When it really just... When anyone asks me to give feedback, I always ask, do you want like the, you know, friendly, you did a good job notes, or do you want the like real honest truth notes?
Yeah, is this a confidence building exercise, or are you really trying to make this better?
Yeah, and sometimes people don't even respond to that email, and then I'm like, okay, well, you don't actually want notes, you know? And then sometimes they'll say, yeah, and then I give them to them, you know? But I always try to be that brutally honest person, because I personally think it's the only way that's the only advice that's going to actually be helpful, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I guess the plus side of being brutally honest is if they don't want that, they'll never come back to you. So it saves you time in the long run. And then if they do want that, then they'll keep coming back and you can just keep being that person. If you just say, "Hey, good job," then you know, maybe they'll just keep reaching out to you to keep looking at stuff because they just want that confidence boost.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's not the type of advice I'm really interested in giving out, to be honest with you.
Right.
It's just not my thing, but I'm definitely with you on that, guys. It's it's really that's part of that building that core group of people as well. Like you're saying, it's, you can just trust people, and you can trust that they're not going to take offense when you tell them how it is or how your, what your status is.
There's a famous story about Hitchcock's wife who saw the cut of the shower sequence and said that I don't know the story well, I'm gonna ruin it, but to some effect that like everyone else was like, holy shit, that's amazing, and she's like, no, it sucks, because at the end she blinks her eyes and she's supposed to be dead, and she's the only person that pointed out the flaw in it.
That's interesting. Yeah, and he rounded off that edge, and then it was that much better.
Yeah. The last question I have is, I know you said you're moving on to original content in your own shows, but after going through this whole process, would you ever do a fan film again or anything like this?
Yeah, man, of course. I mean, I made some amazing relationships, and I mean, we probably have this company now in part because of the taking on that journey, so I couldn't imagine it not happening. I mean, it's definitely been brutal. And I couldn't even put a price tag on the amount of hours that I've spent right. working on it, you know, over the different things and posts and, you know, making everything and writing and all that, and all the different people's work and stuff. But I mean, yeah, I have these amazing partners and this amazing company that we're starting now. And it's really, in some part, come from that, you know. So, yeah, of course. Anybody that's going to take something like creative on, I mean, you couldn't say no, even if it's, you're not going to make any money off it. Like, that's kind of the beauty of fan films, is you're forced most of the time to do it knowing that you're not going to make any money off it, and you just put that much more effort and love and make it that much better because of it. So yeah, I'd do it again for sure.
Awesome. Timothy, just, any final questions? Oh, wait, was that you?
I was going to say not anytime soon, I can tell you that. Still paying for it.
Right.
Nope, I have no other questions. So if you're ready, let's go into the final five.
Let's do it.
All right. So, Ian, we ask these five questions of every filmmaker that's on the podcast. And what we're looking for are 1 to 2 sentence answers. You know, if you need to expand a little bit, you can. But it's really just to try to get like your gut reaction to each of these.
Sure.
Okay. So the first one is, David Fincher says you're doing pretty good if you can get 70% of what you want from your film. Do you agree? And if so, what percentage are you getting from your films right now?
I think I would agree. It's probably even less. It's just such a collaboration, right? Like, you might start out thinking you want one thing and it ends up being totally something totally different. So, yeah, I would tend to agree. I think he's probably, you know, on the high end. He's lucky. I mean, he's a great director, so, but he's shooting a high ratio, so.
Yeah. What's the thing you struggle with the most as a filmmaker?
What's the thing I struggle with the most? And I've seen it through, I think, all the way to the end, but that's kind of a personality defect, start-stop mentality, I think. You've really got to be dedicated to get it, you know, to get it through, not to lose interest in one script and start another project or get busy with your life or whatever. It's dedication, I think, is the thing I probably struggle with the most.
If you could travel back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Oh, wow. Yeah, don't give up. That's it. Just don't give up.
Nice. Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
It's different now than it used to be, but yes, I'd still like to make films that I enjoy and work on with great people or shows. But I think now it's also supporting younger people like Zeke and helping them achieve a career and, you know, doing the same thing that I wanted to do, you know, 15 years ago as well. So it's kind of two parts, myself and other people.
And it's a follow-up question. What was the goal before?
Just for myself.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. That's growth.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Again, the last question, is making movies hard?
Yeah. Yeah, it's really hard. And oftentimes disappointing and not rewarding. I mean, I think if you feel like you have accomplished something, like, that's the real achievement, you know, because then, you know, people have probably seen it, or it made a difference, you know, it made people ask questions, or, you know, or something along those lines. We put together a motto for Chariot Drive, and it's it goes something like, there's a long version of it, but it's create, collaborate, and challenge, because you want to work with people, we want to make stuff, and we want to challenge, you know, people's thoughts and ideas and stuff. So I think if you've done any of those things, then it's successful. But yeah, it's definitely hard.
I think I'm going to modify that question too. Is making movies hard? And if so, why do we do it?
Wow. Yeah, it's definitely hard. Why do we do it? I don't know. There's just some, I don't know. It's one of those things where there's a feeling when somebody is affected by something that you've done artistically, like if it changes people or if, you know, it makes people think, that's just so powerful and rewarding that I think that's what makes it worth it. 'Cause it's a fucking brutal experience. I mean, if you've got no money, you know, like making movies with a budget and making movies on an independent level is, it's just so, the difference is so vast, you know, like it's just so brutal with independent budgets. It's just a fight, a constant fight and battle.
Yeah. Well, it looks like we're going to be in that world for quite a while.
Yeah, right.
But I think you said something that's interesting. And I believe that we've all had this experience with movies and they've touched us so much that we want to make something that lives up to that. And I think that, at least for me, when I started out, I thought that I was going to be able to make a movie that touched me the same way other movies have. And in making my own, I realized I'll never see it the way an audience sees it.
No.
You know, and that's part of the struggle, is you go through this thing and you're trying to make this magical piece that touches people, but you yourself as a filmmaker will never see that thing for what it is. Yeah. So that to me is one of the hardest parts of filmmaking, is that you never really know what you have, and it belongs to the audience after you're done with it.
Yeah, exactly. You can only read the comments or try to avoid reading the comments. What movies was that for you?
For me, it was E.T.
Really?
Yeah. That movie I saw when I was, I think, 4 years old. I saw it in the theater a bunch of times, and it just has always stuck with me. Throughout my whole life, I just always think about that movie, go back to it. There's so many parts of it that I love. I love the intersection of technology and storytelling, and like that they were able to tell that story with the technology at the time. Like, had they done that movie like 20 years earlier, it would have been like probably a guy in like a puppet or like a costume, and it just wouldn't have looked good. So like E.T. looking as good as he does is like one part of what makes that movie great. Such a different type of story, and like the emotional resonance at the very end is like not an ending that is easy to get to and make people feel. And I remember at such a young age, I felt such a strong connection to these characters and felt such an emotion when the movie ended. And there's not many movies that do that.
Wow. That's a good answer. What about you, Auric?
Someone asked me this question recently, and I said Ninja Turtles and Back to the Future. And when I was really young, and I think that's still true. But I mean, I think, you know, when I got a little older, because I saw Alien when I was really young, and it just scared the crap out of me. Alien was also a big inspiration for me too. Just that type of movie, that sci-fi horror, being in space. The focus on those characters, you know, but I mean, if I'm talking about like my young self, it's really probably Ninja Turtles and Back to the Future, those movies. But I didn't really realize I could make movies until much later. But those are my early like movies I was completely obsessed with, you know.
Yeah, man, Back to the Future, that still holds up now. E.T. still holds up now. I just watched that with my 5 year old. And she was just in awe, like from beginning to end, like just, it was wondrous, like gasps and shit happening. And it was an amazing experience to watch that movie through the eyes of my kids again at the sort of same age as I probably would have seen it as well. I mean, that's an amazing achievement for film if you think about it.
Oh my God. Yeah,
totally. Well, that's the dream, to pass on the films to the younger generation, right? The films that we love and keep them alive, you know?
And I'll say one last thing about E.T. The other thing I love about it is it feels like such a personal movie to Spielberg. You know, it's not just big explosions and action scenes. It's like small and personal, even though like kind of the scope of it is big.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe there was a lot of him in that film, more than the later ones. Possibly.
Yeah. definitely more than Ready Player One.
Did you guys
I haven't
not
seen
like
it yet.
I thought it was okay. I think I enjoyed it more than I thought I was going to based on the trailers, you know. But yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen a lot of Spielberg's recent work, but I just don't really feel like he's challenging himself in the same way. Even like as, you know, recently as Minority Report, like I thought that was a very different and interesting movie for him. And like, you know, I don't really feel like he's really making those kinds of different and interesting movies.
He just doesn't feel connected
anymore
to the material.
But I heard The Post was really good. Someone told me that I should see The Post.
No, don't watch
it. I heard mixed feelings about that.
Oh, really? Well, you didn't like The Post, Timothy?
Yeah, it feels like they made it very quickly. It seems like...
Really?
Yeah, it seems like there's no prep on it. Spielberg's job on it is like very rushed. It's shot very almost like a TV show.
Huh.
So, yeah.
Oh, really?
I don't recommend it.
Some AC super film nerd friend of mine on Facebook who may or may not listen to this show was telling me how amazing his camera work and Spielberg's connection
really
to the cinematography in The Post was really inspirational to me. And I was like, well,
I
okay,
like
I gotta
a
see
huge
this movie.
Miss. I feel like usually he's so good with his cameras and he's so good with like the blocking of actors to get more shots out of like one angle.
That's
and
funny.
He didn't do any of that because I feel like it was so rushed that he didn't have time to really plan it out, and he just kind of like got basic coverage and just called it a day.
Wow, now I don't know what to think.
It's so funny, right? Filmmaking, everybody can have such a different... It could just be how you feel on the day can make such a difference to how you take it in as well. Your expectations can make such a difference.
Oh yeah, expectations are huge.
Just, I mean, it can be the difference between a movie that you think was okay or good that just was the worst thing that you've seen this year, like just in how you approached seeing the movie. It's terrifying.
Yeah, anytime a movie gets a lot of hype, you know that there's going to be a lot of people that then don't like it because they go in with the expectations really high and it's hard for a movie to match them.
Yeah, he's got some great movies though. Jurassic Park is
So good, but Jurassic Park is what, like 96?
No, 93 or 4.
Yeah, oh my god.
Yeah, it was Terminator 2 time, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
just after.
Now, Terminator 2 is awesome.
Spielberg still
one of the greatest movies.
I mean, what, Saving Private Ryan was 96 or 97 probably?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's pretty undisputably good.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, same with Schindler's List.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Jaws is actually my favorite movie of all time.
God, I love Jaws.
I'm not a horror fan, but good. That movie is just... And there's some funny stories about that movie as well, about him wanting to change the edits and people convincing him to keep it the same.
Oh, really?
Something about John Williams, yeah. I don't know how much truth there is to this. Could be just, you know, continuing one of those urban legends, but... something about John Williams, he got an early cut of the film and started scoring it, and then... Spielberg and the editor, I forget who edited it, came in with an updated cut, and he convinced them to keep the cut that they had and make it the final cut because the music, he felt that the music was so perfect and the way that it was cut together was already so perfect that it was a mistake. And I guess he talked him out of it. And that was the cut that we all saw, and look what happened.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. There was something about the ending too. They were going to do the ending a little differently, but then like a test screening, the way that people reacted to the exact timing of the ending was so explosive and so like amazing. They're like, okay, it's done. We're not going to go and change that anymore. We're not doing any adjustments. But yeah, that's a special movie. And I feel like that's when I studied when I was writing my feature I'm working on now. Like I studied the timing of like when they, you know, the movie starts, the inciting incident, all that stuff. Cause I feel that movie does a really good job of getting going, you know?
Yeah.
And then also just the time marks of the beats. It's really a well paced movie too, you know? All right. Well, this is like an hour and a half here, so we should probably wrap things up.
Anything else?
Yeah, thanks so much.
Go ahead.
Do you have any other things, Timothy?
No, I can't think of anything. Go ahead. You were going to say something.
No, good, guys. Thank you for the time.
No, thank
you.
Yeah,
that was a lot of fun. Where can people find the Half-Life series, Ian? Where can people see all this stuff?
Well, I think probably Steam is the place to go. You can see it on YouTube, or there's a website that we set up, thefreemanchronicles.com, but you really should see it on Steam. It, you know, it's surrounded by other Half-Life related stuff, and it's from a gamer, so it seems like that's the best place to watch
How
it.
Do you find it on Steam?
You can just search for it. If you just search the Freeman Chronicles, I think it even comes up in Google now.
The Freeman Chronicles, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe I'd like to send you guys the new episode before it comes out and get your feedback and whatnot.
Yeah, I'd love to see it. Yeah, that'd be great.
For somebody who hasn't played the game, then I can comment on it from like a totally different perspective.
Yeah. And then the deck that you're going to send us, are you okay with us sharing that with our listeners for them to see?
Yeah, sure.
Awesome, that'd be great. I think people love seeing that stuff, you know, whenever they can.
Yeah, sure.
Well, thanks, cool. Ian. And then,
yeah, thanks. And we'll also put links to Chariot Drive, and, you know, if you're on Twitter or anything, we'll include that stuff too, just so people can you know, stalk you and check out your work and all that stuff.
That would be great.
Yeah. All right, Timothy, take us out, man.
I just want to say one other thing, because you said that Zeke might listen to the show, so I just kind of want to throw out a thanks to him if he does, because I don't think we'd be here at this point if he hadn't sort of contacted us and stepped in. And there's a whole story behind it, but if you're listening, Zeke, this wouldn't have happened without you, buddy, so thanks for that.
Awesome. And Zeke,
wait, so did he watch the Half-Life, the first episode, and then reach out to you guys and be like, oh, I love this, can I help?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And now we're partners in LA in a post-production house. It's crazy when you think about it.
That's incredible.
It sounds like we need to have a part two with Zeke on here. Talk about this.
Well, that's kind of an incredible story, because, like, you know, people sometimes will, like, you know, want to reach out to a creator or send something, and maybe they don't actually write that email, or they write it and they don't send it. And, like, it's incredible to hear, like, what can come out from just a simple email like that, you know? So
yeah, he's super talented, so... He's got big things ahead of him, I can tell you.
Cool. All right, now we can end it.
So, it's time for the game. The game. What is the game, you ask? It is a handmade home... Wait, it is a homespun, handmade, hand-spun, homemade. It's one of those. Segment created by our producer Eric Toms, where he puts forth a hypothetical indie film quandary quagmire problem for one of us to solve, and we are reading these blind. Ulrich has never heard this, and here we go. I have to pull it up. You're in pre-production for a low-budget road trip film. This is interesting. I think we recently did another road trip film question. The script's climax is a showdown between two friends overlooking a beautiful mesa. It's the portion of the shoot you and the producers are dreading, because all of the locations that fit this description are very expensive. Then, in a stroke of luck, you are contacted by a rancher who has a plot of undeveloped land that would work perfectly. However, there is a catch. The plot has no bathrooms, and the closest facilities are an hour's car ride away. Bringing in porta potties would be very expensive and would really cut into your budget, forcing you to downsize multiple scenes and thereby hurting the overall quality of the film. You can hire a van, but for insurance purposes, you have to hire a dedicated driver, which is still far less than the porta potties, but you lose 2 hours every time a cast or crew member has to go to the bathroom. The last option is just asking everyone to go to the bathroom outdoors, but many members of your team have expressed an extreme dislike to this option. A, do you rent the porta potties and just rewrite the bulk of the film knowing the end result will suffer? B, rent the truck and know that you'll lose 2 hours, if not more, of filming time while you're at the location? C, have everyone go to the bathroom outside and pray no one has to take a 10 too? D, other. I just want to say I want to answer this so badly. Okay. But what do you do, Ulrich? What do you do, director? What do you do?
And this location is the only location option that I have, or I've decided that this is a must-have location and that there's no other location that'll work.
Yes. He doesn't mention the cost of the location. It just said that it would work perfectly. And the other locations are very expensive.
Huh. Okay. And then so seemingly more expensive than porta potties, I would say, right?
I would assume so.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well. So interesting. I feel like Eric has really painted us into the corner here, because he's making it like, you know, basically in this scenario, it's like it's too expensive to do porta potties. It's too expensive to get another location, because porta potties aren't all that expensive. And, you know, even if they're like an hour away, it's like a couple hundred bucks to get porta potties for a day. So, I mean, I'm going to work within Eric's framework just for the sake of this. But I do think the porta potties is the answer, and I don't think it would make me rewrite my whole movie. But let's just imagine it would. Yeah, and also knowing that rewriting the movie would suffer. Like, it's not necessarily, that's not necessarily a given, too. Like, you could rewrite a movie and it not suffer.
Right, right? And but, you might not need to rewrite the movie also, but go on, yes.
Yeah, no, anyways, I want to work with Eric here. So, yeah, I have done multiple shoots where there have been either no bathrooms or very, very hard to access bathrooms. You know, the majority of people just hold it, you know, especially if you only have to be there for like 4 hours, like you could probably make it happen. But he also added that he's just really painting us in the corner here, man, because he already said that a lot of people don't want that as an option, that they don't want to like have to do this, you know, that they don't want to have to only be able to go out to the bathroom outside. So, yeah, I think 2 hours for a bathroom trip. Jeez Louise. Okay, here's what I do. Okay, I got my solution. So, before we leave for the location, I say, everybody, we're going to be in this situation where it's going to take a couple hours for anyone to go to the bathroom. Let's all use the bathroom now before we go. And let's like see, you know, the best that we can do here. We're only going to be at the location for 5 hours. If anybody needs to go to the bathroom, we'll obviously wait for you. We'll make that happen. Like, we're not going to be monsters. Like, that's not a big deal. But like, let's just go into this, like trying to do our best. And if the crew is like unhappy with this approach and this idea, like I won't do this on the morning. It'll be like announced days before. Then I'll rewrite the movie because I love my crew. I'm not going to fuck my crew over. So if my solution to this, you know, and I have to, like, I'm just imagining, I have to have this location. I would go to the crew. I would present my option. If they said, no, that's not acceptable to us, like, you know, you're treating us like animals or whatever, then I would rewrite the movie and get the porta potties. Because I feel like, you know, your crew is your greatest asset. And like, if people are working for you for very little money and they're trusting you and they're coming with you on this adventure of making your movie, like, you really have to back them. And if that means coming up with a creative solution to make it work for them, then I will do that for the crew. But I would go to every length to see if they could like work with me and make it happen, you know, because I know it's possible and I know it's, you know, it is a little bit of a big deal, but like, it's a workable situation. Anyways, what would you do, Liz? What would you do in this situation?
That is a very good answer. That is a deal breaker for me, to not have access to a bathroom. It is a major deal breaker for me. I've got an anxious bladder. I'm just obsessed. Like, I pick hikes based off of whether there's a bathroom there. I sit on the aisle at a movie theater so that I could get out and not disturb anyone when I have to use the facility. Like, this is a thing for me. So I would go into my own personal bank account and front the costs for the porta potties without expecting recoupment, because I know that's not working with Eric, but when have I ever worked with Eric's framework in these questions? I never do. I would not be able to survive 5 hours not using the bathroom. Like, that is an impossibility. And I've had a real traumatic experience peeing in the woods before. So I'm not doing that to myself or to others. So I just can't do it. So I do think it's only a few $100s. I do think that...
Like 500 maximum, right? Like, it's not going to be more than 500. It's very... Bucks.
Like, I would run a GoFundMe. Like, I guess working within the framework of Eric's question, I would do a GoFundMe for porta potties, because maybe I couldn't dip into my own personal bank account. And I don't even know if that works within the framework, but there's no way I am personally going to a film set without access to a bathroom for 5 hours. No, thank you. Never. I would be like, done.
Yeah, that's a good, I like that. I like the idea of like doing a fundraiser to raise
just
the
for
money
bathrooms.
For a bathroom for this one shoot. Because, yeah, I mean, I just can't imagine. I can't imagine a scenario where there's not a way you could funnel money to make this happen, like where you can take budget from something else. Like, oh, like you probably have like $500 budgeted for movie posters or something.
Yeah, your contingency.
Take that movie poster money. Take the contingency, whatever it is. Like, this is a solvable problem. But I mean, Eric wrote it as an unsolvable problem in these ways. So I'm glad that we worked with him to answer the question. But yeah, I mean, I'm the exact opposite for me. I could hold it forever. You know, like, it's not.
That's
a big
how
deal.
Sean also, is. Most people are okay with this. It's just like particular pain point for me. I can't do it.
Yeah. No. And I mean, and it's really, I'm really great. I'm grateful that you have this perspective, but it's actually nice that you do have this perspective, because it does speak to, like, there's probably going to be at least one person on your crew who has the same feeling.
Oh, yeah.
So that's why it's so important to like ask them ahead of time and make sure you get sign off. And if you don't get sign off, like there's also other solutions. Like let's say like you get like, you know, 90% of your crew to say, yes, I'm good with that. But there's like one person who says, no, I can't do it. Then you could be like, look, like just for this one day, we'll hire someone to fill in for you. And then you'll be back the next day, you know, like and see if they're comfortable with that and they're OK with it. But, you know, there's just a lot of different creative problem solving that can be done for this scenario.
I'm just realizing like this is probably dehumanizing, but this is a great way to start a sentence. But like, why not bring kids potties and to the woods so that people could at least sit down, and you line them with plastic bags and people have their own makeshift bathroom experience, right? Like,
yeah,
that is very possible.
You do it for my daughter.
Yeah, I'm not against that. I just literally, I need somewhere to sit down that is a bathroom like place. It doesn't have to have walls. It just needs to be a toilet. That's all.
That's another really great solution. Cause yeah, we have this little portable potty for BB, and it's got a little built in thing for plastic bags. So it's like kind of thing that you plug in and you pull it down and it basically makes it so that like you can just do a poop or a pee anywhere and it just goes right into a little handy bag and you're done, you know? So like, I'm sure you could find that.
I would be okay with that. I think, though, still, I don't think I could ever ask Cast, can you use my son or my daughter's like tiny portable potty to go to the bathroom? Like, I don't think I could ever make that ask of anyone.
I don't think there's anything wrong with a conversation as long as you present it in the right way.
Sure.
And I mean, if they're going to get offended from a suggestion of a solution, then they're probably not people that you want to collaborate with. Like, I don't know. I feel like most things, like if you come to it with the right energy, like you can have a conversation and like, you know, if someone's like, oh, that's a terrible idea. You're like, yeah, sure. Okay. Yeah. Off the table. We're not going to do that. You know,
it's a good question, Eric. You did all right.
Yeah, no, you did good. It's interesting. You really paint us into a corner, but I think we got a good conversation out of it because we've talked a lot about this.
Yes. With that, you can always send us a comment, question, suggestion, especially about this question, to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. If you like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. Finally, check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast and YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimut, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert California Jones for doing our social media. Thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for just being awesome. Most importantly, thanks to all of you for listening, and talk to y'all next week.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, didn't see that coming, and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.